Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
Sure. Well, this is Scott Bond. I'm a criminology professor at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. I'm also an author and blogger. I have a regular column on psychologytoday.com called Wicked Deeds. I blog about crime-related issues and a lot of things about serial killers and mass murders and so forth. And I recently wrote a book called Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers. And it's I would call it a pop culture look at serial killers in society. And so it's a little bit different. Rather than being a purely academic treatise, an analytical approach, and rather than being a true crime sort of rendition, what I try to do is look at serial killers, how they actually serve as a mirror, a very dark mirror of society itself. And I think that is part of the appeal of serial killers, that people are just absolutely fascinated by and compelled to understand why serial killers are drawn to kill people who are typically strangers. They don't kill people that they know normally. It's complete strangers, and they do so for their own amusement. It's not out of rage. It's not out of vengeance or even greed. Typically, it has much more to do with some sort of a fantasy need that killing serves. And that's just so far and astray from the normal behavior of human beings that we're compelled to understand it.
Aaron and I were talking about the definition of a serial killer, and it's really the ones that you find online are just somebody that murders 3 or more people over the course of a month or longer. And that really leaves something to be desired there. So, like, what would you kind of define the serial killer generally as?
Okay, well, that's also a great question. And as you indicated, there's considerable debate about it. Up until 1974, the term serial killer didn't even exist. It was coined that year by a gentleman by the name of Robert Ressler, one of the premier FBI profilers from Quantico, Virginia, in the FBI, who unfortunately died about a year ago. But he's the one who came up with the term serial killer. Before that, they were referred to as mass murderers, and they were typically lumped together with mass murderers. A mass murder is a one-time event, like the Newtown shooting or Columbine or the Colorado movie theater shooting perpetrated by James Holmes. Those are mass murders. Serial killings are a series of events. And the FBI's classic definition, the one that they came up with in the 70s, you just alluded to, which was three victims at minimum in separate crime scenes and events. And here's the key, that these events have what is known as an emotional cooling off period on the part of the perpetrator between them. And there, this is where the Ted Bundys and the Jeffrey Dahmers and so forth will blend back into society and their seemingly normal lives, and they just go about their business. They live day to day and function in society until this bizarre, overwhelming need to kill, this bloodlust, comes over them again. Now, that's the classic definition. However, to confuse things, provided it, to create some confusion, in 2005, the FBI changed the definition somewhat. They reduced the number of killings to two, and they also eliminated the emotional cooling off period. Now, why did they do that? They said that for the purposes of investigation, for the purposes of tracking these individuals and linking the crime scenes and going about the business of profiling them, that the it didn't matter whether it was two or three, and the emotional cooling off period didn't seem to matter. Now, from my perspective, because my book is really more of a look at the true, what I call celebrity monsters who have emerged among serial killers, the Ted Bundys, the Jeffrey Dahmers, the Son of Sam, Boston Strangler, Zodiac, on and on. These individuals fit that classic definition, the three or more with the emotional cooling off period. So I've retained that. I use that in my book because I think it's important from a pop culture perspective. You know, one of the allures, one of the macabre but enticing things about people like Ted Bundy is their ability to blend back into society and seemingly function as extremely normal individuals. Some of them are just, I mean, incredibly normal. The gentleman that I corresponded with extensively for several years and who I write about quite a bit in my book is a guy by the name of Dennis Rader, who named himself Bind, Torture, Kill, Bind, B-I-N-D, as in tie up, torture, and kill. He gave himself that name. And here's a guy who was the president of his Lutheran Church Association. He was a Boy Scout leader. He ran a business. He was, to the outside world, to everyone looking on, seemingly as normal as apple pie. And he was married, and he had two children that he raised. They're I believe, in their 40s now. Dennis Rader's 66. And it took them 30 years to catch this guy. He was so unassuming, it literally took them 30 years to catch him. And so it's the Dennis Raiders and the Son of Sam's and the Ted Bundys that really become these celebrity monsters in our popular culture that are almost glorified through movies and books and poems and jokes and, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer cannibal jokes, etc. And so I maintain that original definition of three or more with the cooling off period.
Do you have like a subcategory? Because I would put like John Wayne Gacy and maybe the Cleveland Strangler into one category. I would put Ted Bundy and Richard Ramirez into another category, more or less kind of based on their motives. But
Absolutely. The one thing that serial killers have in common, and people ask me this all the time, is what is the common thread? The common thread is this is a fantasy need. Their killings serve some sort of a fantasy need. I should even back up here and give a little more information. Serial killers are extremely rare. They represent less than 1% of all homicides every year. Now, that's a good thing, you know, that's good. But at the same time, it the part of the fascination is the fact that they kill for different reasons. They kill out of a fantasy need, out of some, in many cases, they're not even sure why they kill. They're just driven compulsively to do it. Dennis Rader, BTK once again, he didn't know how to describe this compulsion, but he had a name for it. He called it Factor X. And he told me when Factor X comes over him, it's absolutely, there's no denying it. And they fantasize about these killings, and they work themselves up almost like foreplay. It's almost a sexual thing. They work themselves up into a fever. And when it reaches a certain point, a tipping point, they can't deny it any longer, and they have to go out and kill. And that is very different than the characteristics of the average homicide in the United States. Most murders in the United States, of which there are approximately 15,000 now annually, 15,000 murders, the majority of them are not first-degree premeditated murders with deliberation, where someone thinks about it in advance, they plan it, and they go and kill the way a serial killer does. What's much more likely is to get into a barroom brawl with somebody that you never met before, and it escalates into a murder. So most murders are actually second-degree murders where there's no premeditation or deliberation, but someone becomes enraged and decides to kill another person in the heat of the moment, or manslaughter where there is no intent to kill at all, and it ends up as an accident out of, say, a barroom brawl where there is actually no intent to kill. Those are much far more likely scenarios than the premeditated Jack the Ripper, Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy sort of serial killings.
How does this cooling off period work? I imagine that some serial killers, their period could be a month, and for others it could be several months.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be days, weeks, months, and in the case of Dennis Rader, BTK, it even was years from sometimes. And the motive that drives them to kill is not necessarily sexual in nature. It's believed that about 50% of serial killings committed by men are sexual in nature, but the other 50% are more about, say, domination and control. It might, the killing might be much more related to just physically having control of life and death over an individual. It might not even necessarily be about sex. But what some of them are able to do, and BTK was notorious in this regard, is he would save trophies and souvenirs from his victims, from these women. He would keep scarves and items of clothing and identification, photographs, that sort of thing, and keep them in literally a treasure chest, and which he called the mother lode. He kept this in his basement, locked up. And what he would do from time to time is, when he would feel this urge coming on, he would dress up cutouts and dolls in this paraphernalia, and he would relive his crimes, literally fantasize and relive his killings. And this sometimes would give him enough satisfaction that it would inhibit him from having to go out and kill again. So he, at a very visceral level, he knew what he was doing was wrong, and he even tried to control it in some way. But it ultimately would reach a point that these reenactments and autoerotic fantasy wouldn't be enough to sustain him.
I always wonder if they feel it's wrong, or if they just know that society views it as being wrong and evil, therefore they cover up their actions.
Well, that's a great question, too. You know, a lot of these individuals are psychopaths, and I should define what a psychopath is. And a psychopathic individual is one who is, for all extents and purposes, just completely unplugged from human emotion and empathy. They can't feel it. They know excitement, they know exhilaration, adrenaline, that kind of thing. But in terms of fear, in terms of remorse, pity, those sorts of emotions, they just don't feel. Consequently, they're able to do these horrible things to people with no sense of conflict or remorse whatsoever. And as such, they're not mentally ill. The things that these do, you might say, well, how can that not be crazy, killing and eating people? Well, from the criminal justice perspective, from the standpoint of the law, if an individual knows something is wrong when they do it, but they do it anyway, then they're not insane. So most serial killers, in fact, the vast majority, do not fit the definition of not guilty by reason of insanity, because they know it's wrong. They simply do not care. But what makes someone like a Ted Bundy or a Jeffrey Dahmer or a Dennis Rader so chilling and so frightening is that they are able to mimic emotions quite well. Dennis Rader was able to fool his own family for 30 years. They had no idea that he was doing these things because he knew what to say, he knew the right thing to do, and he knew the right reactions, and he could mimic them. He simply didn't feel them. And as such, these individuals rarely make mistakes. They're very cold-blooded and calculating. They rarely make mistakes because they have no fear. They have no fear of being caught or remorse about what they do. So they rarely make mistakes, and that's what makes them so, on one hand, so such a curiosity and so fascinating, but it also is what makes them so prolific and able to get away with it for so long. Bundy killed 36 women. Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, killed 43 women. So these individuals are unfortunately very good at what they do.
And there's so many dimensions there that you're right. That is what makes us, you know, intrigued by this subject and what makes people want to know more. How can somebody do these horrible things? What drives them? What is their motivation? And it's kind of disgusting on one side because they're the bad guy and we're kind of all giving them the focus. But yet it's their actions that appeal to us as far as interest goes.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the analogies that I use, and I think it's a fairly apt analogy, is serial killers are very much like a great white shark is in nature. They're rare, they're quite exotic, and they're also quite deadly. And it's that combination of factors being rare, exotic, and deadly that is, I think, compelling to a lot of people. I mean, we actually have a shark week that we celebrate in society, thanks to the Discovery Network. You know, we don't yet have a serial killer week, but I wouldn't be surprised if one is coming down the road, you know, given the appeal of all of these shows, the CSI shows and The Following, and True Detective, and Hannibal, and Criminal Minds, and, you know, on and on and on. We, you know, it's a very, very clear indication that we are very interested in this stuff. But, you know, what happens, and this is one of the arguments, and actually one of the main points of my book, is I contend that there's a blurring effect that happens in the mass media and in entertainment, where Jeffrey Dahmer becomes almost synonymous with Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter. And they're described in very much the same way, as pure evil, as monsters, vampires, Dracula. They use all these sort of terms. And in fact, it happened very, very, knowingly in 1991, when that was the year that Jeffrey Dahmer was finally caught. And it was also the same year that Silence of the Lambs came out in the movie theaters, and Jeffrey Dahmer was referred to as the real-life Hannibal Lecter. And I think oftentimes these individuals become, as I said, sort of interchangeable. And to the average person, it almost doesn't matter whether they're watching the news and they're seeing the story of a real-life serial killer, or they're watching The Following or True Detective or Criminal Minds. It's all entertainment. It's all popcorn entertainment. And we buy T-shirts and we buy books and movies. And as I said, Jeffrey Dahmer jokes are still part of the popular culture. They are very much an entertainment commodity. And what that does is I argue it numbs us and we become callous to the fact that these individuals are killing real innocent people. In the case of Ted Bundy, he killed 36 women at least, and yet can anyone remember the name of one of these women? We all know Ted Bundy, but can anyone remember the names of these women? And I think that's an indication of, you know, the focus is on the celebrity monster, as I said.
All right. We want to take a moment to give some time for our sponsor, Audible. They carry 150,000 titles on their site. I'm currently reading or listening to Revival by Stephen King, which is pretty good. I like the a couple of his other ones better, but I'm in the middle of listening to that. Our current author on right now, Scott, his book is called Why We Love Serial Killers, and I'm about to go pick that one up too. It sounds great.
This is why we had the author on, is he actually goes into serial killers from our angle, our fascination with them, and our questions. So if anybody out there is fascinated by serial killers or why they do what they do, or the media's fascination with them, feeding our interest, then this book has a lot of answers for you. So I would highly suggest, especially if reading's not your thing or you have a long commute, definitely you could pick this up from audible.com. You could pick this up and I would say your questions will be answered. It's a pretty complete book on the subject, at least from our point of view and from our questions that we have about serial killers.
And I going out on Amazon and a few other sites looking at the ratings of his book, that's mostly all 5-star ratings. But if you're one of the people that wants to rate it 1-star, Audible allows you to return the book, no questions asked, and they'll let you take out another book.
Right. And if you want to get a free book from Audible, all you have to do is go to www.audiblepodcast.com/Generation Y. That's GENERATIONWHY. And you can get a free audiobook. Well, you mentioned that the serial killers often keep mementos. It's interesting when we bring up murderabilia, yep, that there are people in the public who want to keep mementos from these serial killers.
Oh, my God. Yeah, absolutely. I devote the 11th chapter, in fact, of my book to that phenomenon. I talk a bit about groupies. There are those who, particularly women, who are interested in these individuals, which could be a whole topic for a show unto itself. I call it, it's the bad boy effect on steroids. You know, he may be bad, but you know, he's my Charlie Manson. You know, he's my Ted Bundy. And as you know, Manson has been linked to this young woman, although now it looks like the pending nuptials are off. But as you mentioned, there are individuals who may not be the groupies, but nevertheless collect the so-called murderabilia, murder memorabilia called murderabilia of these individuals. People literally collect toenail clippings and hair clippings from death row from these people, and articles of clothing, and photographs and signed doodles that, you know, some of them are artists and they paint and draw in prison, and these works of art sell for actually quite a lot of money. One of the craziest things of all, it's all pretty crazy, but one of them that really struck me, there was a female serial killer, which debunks another mystery myth that there are no female serial killers. There definitely are. There was one out in California. Her name was Dorothea Puente, a Latina, who was a black widow serial killer. She was poisoning her elderly house guests. She ran a rooming house, and she would milk them dry for their insurance money and government money, and then kill them, and she'd bury them in her backyard. She had a burial ground. You can actually buy, and I'm not making this up, little plastic baggies of soil from her burial ground in her backyard. You can buy this stuff on the internet. And there are actually websites dedicated to the sale of this stuff. It's, you know, I mean, truth is stranger than fiction, but people do collect this stuff.
I only get a problem when, if somebody is contacting, say, John Wayne Gacy in prison, sending him money for a painting. I don't I don't agree with that. But as far as the market for murderabilia, I don't mind if you've come across, say, a knife that was used and now you, the individual, not the murderer, want to resell it or gift it or whatever. I don't have as much of a problem there as I do with people that directly associate with the murderer themselves trying to get letters or toenails or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah, well, actually, you know, you're bringing up an important point that I go into in my book is these individuals, the convicted felons, are not allowed to benefit financially directly from their creative work, like telling their stories. And there's actually a series of laws called the Son of Sam laws that are as a result of David Berkowitz, who I also corresponded with extensively and met with in prison, because he was offered literally millions of dollars for his story after he was caught and incarcerated. And the state of New York said, there's no way that's going to happen. So there are laws that keep these guys from benefiting financially from their stories. But also, there's laws called notoriety for profit laws. And these are at a state level. And there's eight or ten states that have them now that they cannot benefit financially by selling their stuff, whether it's their toenails or their, you know, works of art or whatever. But as you indicated, there's middlemen. There are agents who will develop relationships with these guys in prison and say, hey, why don't you start painting and I'll be your agent. Send me this stuff. Now, it's the middlemen, the agents who are legally able to sell this stuff and make money, but there's nothing to keep them. There's absolutely nothing to keep them from sending a little bit of cash to these prisoners or sending them gifts or things like that. As long as the killers are not directly selling things to the public and benefiting financially. For example, although she's not a serial killer, Jodi Arias, the one who was convicted of killing her former boyfriend in Arizona last year, mm-hmm. she was selling her courtroom doodles. You know, she was a photographer and actually a pretty good artist. She was selling her courtroom doodles and drawings on eBay up until the point that she was found guilty, and now she can no longer do that.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Wow. I didn't even think about they could do it up until the point they're guilty.
That's right. Until they become a convicted felon, it's totally legal.
Do we have some understanding of the thoughts or the feelings or emotions that people who collect these items feel when they get, say, Dahmer's watch?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a range. It's a great question. And again, I go into this quite an extent in my book. There, it serves a multitude of purposes. Some of these individuals want to simply get close to infamy, you know, and it gives them a thrill, sort of a vicarious thrill of being close to these individuals. In some cases, and this gets more to the groupie thing, they think that the criminals are misunderstood souls that only they understand. And that's the, kind of the bad boy thing. You know, he may be a bad boy, but he's my bad boy and I can fix him. You know, so there's a bit of that going on. But there's also something called the talisman effect. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, the talisman effect. And I've had heard people describe that. What it is a sense that these artifacts have almost magical powers, that people like Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer are somehow unique individuals that are almost from like another world, and that they have magical powers associated with them, even if these are dark powers, and that by somehow holding something or touching something that they had, it will imbue upon you these magical forces and maybe even be a protective force of some kind. It's called the talisman effect, and I've heard a number of people describe that.
So it's sort of like Halley's Comet. It only comes around every so many years. So it must mean something. It has importance.
Exactly. And some of these things go for big money. John Wayne Gacy, who was a very prolific painter on death row, and he painted, his alter ego was Pogo the Clown. A lot of your listeners are probably aware that, or perhaps not, but I'll explain. In addition to being a prolific serial killer, his hobby, other than killing, was going to children's hospitals dressed up as a clown named Pogo, and he would entertain them. This was literally his hobby. Well, he was obsessed with clowns, and when he was on death row, he began painting a series of clown paintings. He painted other things too, but mostly clowns. His paintings go for $25,000-$30,000 a piece.
We have a friend here in Kansas City who has an oddity shop, Noir Arts and Oddities, and she sells, you know, like a baby fetus in a jar, or old medical equipment. And it's interesting that even those items, you know, something from, you know, an arcane, you know, something from the past is still treasured today. But she will get people in her shop all the time that offer to sell her things like murderabilia. And it kind of is a different subset, a different genre of the oddities and the, I guess, the power of what we think the history or our current society holds dear, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And it certainly is an obsessed subculture of individuals. And I'll tell you a quick little story of something that I was given that certainly would be murderabilia, but I have no intention of selling it or getting rid of it. I don't intend to or want to profit from it. It's certainly a curiosity. I in my correspondence with BTK, Dennis Rader, Bind, Torture, Kill, after a year or so, I got a package from him, and in it was actually a quite lovely hand-painted card, about a little larger than a standard postcard, of a floral arrangement, flowers in a vase. And I'm thinking, why the heck would Dennis Rader send me this? And then I flipped it over, and it was signed Dana Sue Gray. Dana, a female named Dana Sue Gray. And I know who Dana Sue Gray is. She's a female serial killer who's serving multiple life sentences in California for killing three men out there. Well, here's the story. Dennis explains it to me in his letter. He says, Scott, this woman sent this to me, Dana Sue Gray. She's got a thing for me. And who does she think she is? She only killed three people. She's not even in my league. So here, you can have it.
What?
True story.
Wow. That's, I don't even, Yeah, that's shock and awe right there, hearing that reaction. Not even in my league.
Yeah, she's not even in my league. So here, so I was basically, I was re-gifted a little love token from one serial killer to another.
Well, but you have this great story that goes with it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Well, the, another author we had on, Kevin Sullivan, he got the kill bag. Ted Bundy's kill bag, which inspired him to write the book. Now, he got the bag from a police officer or detective that, you know, had it as evidence, so it wasn't...
He has one of the trash bags, you should say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but he has no intention of selling it, and I don't fault him or you for accepting a gift. You know, it's not, to me, it's, you didn't pay for it. This guy did not benefit from you receiving this item.
Right, right. It's an oddity, and another thing that Dennis Rader does is it's fascinating. It gets to his meticulous mind. By the way, this guy is an absolutely meticulous individual who is not only a psychopath but a complete narcissist. I mean, he is just absolutely self-obsessed. But what he does, he's not allowed to have a computer or any art supplies other than little colored pencils. And so he creates his own prison stationery using colored pencils. And it looks like business stationery. And he literally at the top, it's signed. It says, from the desk of Dennis L. Rader, established 2005, which is the year that he went to prison. And what he does is he's got two different prison logos. One is he takes the D of Dennis, puts it on its back so that it's like a cave, so that it looks like a little, you know, an open cave. And every letter has a picture of something happening in the cave. And it's usually seasonally correct. So it might be a snowman in the winter or birds and chirping and flowers in the spring. And every one of his letters comes personalized that way. And he signs each letter, Dennis, but the name Dennis is in the form of a shark. So he's actually created his own prison logo in a shark because that's how he sees himself. He sees himself as a shark.
Do many of these captive serial killers feel the need to stay relevant?
Depending upon their motivation, absolutely. And Dennis Rader is right at the top of that list. He is a complete narcissist once again, and he has just recently, in addition to corresponding with me, he very much wanted to come out with his own official autobiography. And the problem with that is he's, as I said, he's not allowed to financially benefit in any way from his own story. And in fact, a number of these killers often have their victims' families in a consortium or a group that will attempt to block anything that they do in order to achieve additional infamy or any kind of financial compensation for their work. So Dennis actually worked with the victims' lawyers and brought in an author, and the official BTK book is going to be coming out. And as only Dennis Rader can do, he issued essentially a press release from his prison cell saying, look what I am doing. I am going to write this book because people need to hear my story. They need to understand me because I'm so fascinating, and I'm going to contribute the money to the victims' families. Aren't I a great person? Now, what he's confusing there and obscuring for the public is the fact that the only reason that he can even put this book out is because all of the money is going to the victims' families. So he's confused that. And, of course, it's all about him, and therefore he believes that society will benefit from, you know, learning about the great man. And, by the way, I should add that that's very much the way I got him to correspond with me. I played Clarice Starling, you know, from Silence of the Lambs. And when I wrote my first letter to him, I said, Mr. Rader, I'm a criminologist, a college professor, and I want to write a book about the public's fascination with serial killers, and I think I can learn from you. Well, guess what? He wrote back immediately because he wants to remain relevant.
Have you ever seen the documentary I Survived BTK?
I actually have not, no.
Okay, it's out on Netflix. It's okay as far as, you know, quality or production-wise, but it's one of the surviving children of the family that BTK wiped out.
Oh.
And he's the main character in the documentary, and it just follows him around, but it shows how his life is pretty much turned to utter crap because of this event. And it's really sad because he has terrible luck. His family is surviving family members and whatever. It's really heart-wrenching to watch, but at the same time, I think it focuses on the victim and not so much on Dennis.
Yeah, yeah. It from what you're describing, it sounds like it was the Otero family, his first murder. Dennis Rader's first killing was, in fact, a mass murder. He miscalculated. He went to the house expecting to find just the daughter, but most of the family members were home. And so he, in his words, "I didn't get all dressed up for nothing." So he killed all of the family members who were home, but a couple of them were not. And I suspect that's what you're referring to there.
Yeah, it was the son. I forgot his name now, but the whole movie pretty much follows him around in his current life.
It's sad, you know, and you bring up such a good point, because it's not only the victims, the surviving family members of the victims, but I would also add in the families of the serial killers themselves, because Jeffrey Dahmer's father and mother went through absolute hell as they were scrutinized and ridiculed, you know, when Jeffrey Dahmer was caught. And so the victims come in many forms. You know, I would suggest that you know, the killers themselves and Dennis Rader's wife Paula has just completely gone into seclusion. The only one who's made any real public statements are his daughter, Dennis Rader's daughter. His son is the only one who actually visits Dennis in prison. The former wife and daughter do not. But, you know, these individuals have been, you know, had their lives torn apart as well.
I only know about BTK because he was in Wichita, Kansas, which isn't too far from Kansas City. So
that's right. Yeah. And I would go as far as to say that if he had been killing in New York City as opposed to Wichita, Kansas, which is, you know, it's a major city, but not of the, you know, the size of New York or Los Angeles, BTK would probably be the most notorious serial killer of all time because of the nature of his killings and the fact that they went on for so long and he wasn't apprehended.
And it's possible that if he was doing those in a bigger city, he might have been able to get away with a lot more.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I got to know a gentleman who was just so helpful to me in my research and has just been a real gentleman. His name is Roy Hazelwood, and he is one of the three original FBI profilers there in Quantico, Virginia. Yeah, it was John Douglas, who has written a lot of books. Bob Ressler, the one who, you know, died recently, who came up with the term serial killer, and then Roy Hazelwood. And Hazelwood has interviewed them all. He interviewed Dahmer and Gacy and Bundy and all of them. And he said, without a doubt, he said the most stone cold psychopath that he's ever been around is Dennis Rader.
You know, that's something that's completely believable. If anyone were to look over the images of all these men, I would totally agree just by looking at a single image that Dennis Rader fits that.
Yeah, he completely dehumanized his victims. They weren't victims. They weren't even humans. They were projects. He referred to them as interesting projects, and it felt nothing more than the way he would explain his murders and in letters and as well as he did court after he was caught. There was never even a trial. He admitted to his guilt right away, and I believe the reason he did so is it allowed him to have the grandstand to sit there and explain what he did and how, you know, it took authorities 30 years to catch him. So he was able to, you know, put himself in this position of once again, of superiority. And in almost the same fashion that someone would describe a recipe or how to build a model airplane, that's the way he would describe torture and dismemberment. It was just, you know, it's just incomprehensible.
Do you think that serial killers do sabotage themselves so they'll get caught?
You know, that's a great question, and it's one of the great myths out there. I call it a myth. And in fact, chapter two of my book, I completely devote to debunking a number of myths about serial killers. One, that they're all men. Two, that they're all white. Three, that they're all evil geniuses. And one of the myths is the fact that they want to get caught. I do not believe that the vast majority of them, I don't want to say that none of them do, but the vast majority do not. They enjoy killing far too much. I think here's what happens is some of them eventually get careless and sloppy. You know, you can't kill forever without making a mistake. And the classic example here is a guy by the name of Joel Rifkin, who was the most prolific serial killer in the state of New York, in the history of the state of New York. He killed 17 prostitutes in the mid-90s. And he was so meticulous and disposing of these bodies that the police didn't even realize the serial killer was operating. What happened was he got careless. After victim number 17, he got lazy and a bit sloppy, and he was driving around with a decomposing body in the back of his Mazda pickup truck, and it was literally rotting back there, and it smelled. He was pulled over for a minor traffic infraction. His inspection sticker had expired, and a state trooper pulled him over. And when the trooper pulled him over and walked up to the truck, he smelled this horrible stench, and he made Joel open the back of the truck, and in there was a decomposing corpse. And Joel Rifkin, being a complete psychopath and unflappable in the situation, said to the trooper, "Yeah, she was a prostitute, and I picked her up in Manhattan. Things went bad. I had to kill her. Do you think I should get a lawyer?"
Oh, my gosh.
And a little out of touch.
And they didn't, and the trooper was mortified, of course, but he didn't know that he had just caught a serial killer until he took Rifkin into the headquarters, and they started interrogating him, and Rifkin eventually said, "Yeah, and there's 16 more."
It's one of those things where I agree with you. I think that they don't want to get caught. They would continue on until they get caught, but I don't really think that they either they get lazy, they don't care, but at the same time, he has no clue that this is really that bad of a situation. So he can drive around with a dead body in the back of his car and not think twice about it.
Yeah.
If you take something simple like a drug smuggler, you know, a lot of these guys, they can have a kilo of cocaine on them and not sweat at all. Whereas if I put a kilo of cocaine on you, told you to go, you know, walk through a courthouse, you'd probably freak out. But
yep,
it's the level of how cool and calm can you make yourself. And as a psychopath or a serial killer, it doesn't matter if there's a dead body in the trunk of their car. They're calm and collected and doesn't faze them.
Exactly. And in fact, I have another great BTK story in exactly that regard. I asked Rader in one of my letters, tell me the moment that sticks out most in your mind, in all of this. And he told me that when he was in the middle of his killing spree, his dream had always been to be a cop. And in fact, Dennis Rader has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice administration from I think it's Wichita State College. And so he had always dreamed of being a cop. He never made it. But what he did, what he was able to accomplish is he became a city inspector. He worked for the city, and he was like a compliance inspector. He came around to people's homes, and if your dog wasn't on a leash or if your grass was too long, he had some authority. He carried a badge to issue citations. So it's as close as he got to being a cop, but he got off on it. It gave him this sense of power and control and domination that he wanted. But even better for him, when he went to receive his badge as a city inspector, he had to go into the municipal headquarters in Wichita. And guess what was there? That was the home of the BTK war room that was all set up for years trying to catch BTK. Well, the guy who gave him his badge, whoever was in charge, the sergeant or whatever, took him in there for a little look and see.
Like a tour. Said,
yeah, a tour. Took a tour of the BTK war room. And so Dennis said, what a rush. It was the greatest moment of his life. Here I am giving a tour of the war room that's set up to catch me, and they have no idea.
Well, of course, because that shows him how important he is, that multiple people are searching for him, researching him, writing about him.
That's right. And in fact, that they're doing it right there and showing it to him. He's, he's the great man and so much smarter than them. They have no idea who he is.
Do you how much credence do you give to like profilers, people that are like, OK, I can look at this crime scene and this chain of events and know how this person is or how they think?
These are such great questions, and they're questions that I that a lot of people want to know the answers of. And so I dedicated also a chapter of my book to this. Is criminal profiling, is it art, is it magic, is it science, voodoo, what is it? And I'll tell you how it works, what it's based upon. It's based on what is known as an inductive form of analysis. And what I mean by that is it starts with the observations in a crime scene where there's an unknown perpetrator. So in other words, a local jurisdiction, they believe that there's a serial killer, and the FBI come in and they take a hold of the crime scene, and all of the evidence, all the physical evidence, everything that's known about these crime scenes is recorded. And it's then put into a computer for analysis back in Quantico, where everything that is known about every serial killer investigation since the 1970s is warehoused, all of the data. And what they try to do is match up characteristics from this unknown perpetrator on the loose currently to cases that have been solved in the past. And from that, they're able to get a good sense of the at least generally speaking, the behavioral profile of this individual. And sometimes it's uncannily accurate in an absolutely amazing way. Is it foolproof? Absolutely not. There had never been really studies. Like, I've asked the question, how many occasions, what percentage of the time does the profile that the FBI comes up with match a perpetrator once he or she is apprehended? And I've never been able to get a straight answer to that question. But I have talked to many detectives who have worked on these sorts of cases where the FBI has come in and they have said without a doubt the profile that they received from the FBI was very useful in the detection and apprehension. So is it foolproof? No, it's not foolproof, but it's a useful tool. And I might add to that, my friend Roy Hazelwood who is now retired, I think he's probably in his 70s, he's retired in the Washington, D.C. area. He's the one who's credited with coming up with what is known as the organized versus disorganized killer categorization. And what that is very broadly speaking, and this is part of the profiling process, very broadly speaking, there's two kinds of serial killers in very broad brush strokes. One is the meticulous, psychopathic, unflappable, unemotional Ted Bundy type. That's one category. These individuals don't make mistakes. They have plans what to do with the bodies. They dismember. They're very meticulous. The other kind of serial killer, the disorganized type, is the homicidal maniac type. This is the kind that does not make plans. Oftentimes kills and just leaves the body in a bloody mess right where they found it. And these individuals oftentimes are very mentally ill lunatics, and they don't function well in society. The classic disorganized serial killer from history is Jack the Ripper. And I've talked to some of the profilers about this. I don't believe, nor do they believe, that Jack the Ripper was the a medical surgeon or part of the royal family or any of these conspiracies. I think he was a true homicidal maniac that did not function at all. The rage of his killings, the way he left the bodies, just where he found them on a street corner, is an indication of a very, very unstable individual.
To me, like, I think of Robert Burdella or the Cleveland Strangler. I mean, these guys did function in society, but they were a mess, and they would yep. just chop the body up, put it in a garbage bag, and let the trashman pick it up, which that's a lot different than, say, Ted Bundy or even Richard Ramirez to me.
Yeah, well, Ramirez is a fascinating individual who was somewhere in between. He was not quite organized, and he was not quite disorganized. And in fact, his modus operandi was so unusual. He would just go into a neighborhood in suburban Los Angeles, and he killed all over L.A., which is why he just terrified the entire city. He would go into a neighborhood that he just didn't know, which is also contrary to most serial killers. Most serial killers have a zone that they're comfortable in and that's familiar to them, whereas Ramirez would go into an unknown neighborhood, and he would just look for a house with the window open, and he would crawl in not knowing who he was going to find in there. And depending upon who he and what he found, he would just make it up on the fly. If it was a lone woman, maybe he would rape her, maybe he wouldn't. He would rob her, he would kill her. If it was a couple, he might, kill the man first and then do something with the woman. It was very unusual. And so my point being is that these individuals don't necessarily fit neatly into one category or another.
It's a mess, but that's why people are interested, is to try to define, to try to see if they can figure out the puzzle here.
Exactly. We have, there's this case that is still open. The so-called Long Island serial killer, and these bodies started showing up a few years ago on a very remote beach out in Long Island, Gilgo Beach, but the individual, much like the Zodiac or Jack the Ripper, just disappeared, and they haven't found any bodies lately. But it's a great mystery, and it remains an open case. And I mentioned that I blog about these things on Psychology Today. My blog is Wicked Deeds, is the name of it. And the article that I wrote about the Long Island serial killer just continues to just get hits all over the world. It's a case and a story that just seems to fascinate people.
Yeah, we discussed that on our program with the author Robert Kolker, who had written the book Lost Girls. And uh-huh. One of the questions I had going into it was, do we know that there's a serial killer operating with prostitutes or women who have what we would term a risky business? Mm-hmm. You would think that they're at risk from more than just one person. And
yeah.
So when you have people disappearing or bodies turning up, how do you determine it? Of course, Robert Kolker was able to shed more light on why this is most likely a serial killer that's operating out there in Long Island.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, bodies were found in, very similar burlap bags, and dismembered bodies were buried in plastic. So there's a pattern there. There's definitely a pattern. But you bring up a very good important point, is that unless the forensic evidence exists for these crime scenes to be linked, it's possible for a serial killer to operate without anyone being aware that there even is one. And so there are documented cases of hundreds of serial killers throughout just U.S. history. And I imagine that the numbers are actually a lot higher, because up until the 1970s, the methods of identification were not very sophisticated. And I'm sure that there were a number of cases that were just never even identified.
Yeah, there are serial killers who just operate. And then there are serial killers who reach out many times to the press.
Yep, yep. Really good point. And in fact, that's why I went specifically to Dennis Rader, who called himself Bind, Torture, Kill, and Son of Sam, David Berkowitz, he called himself Son of Sam. I went to those two individuals because they gave themselves essentially their brand names. They named themselves in letters to the police. They both very much wanted to terrorize society. They wanted attention. They wanted to make a statement. And my book is all about why this happens, why these individuals become celebrity monsters. And I argued that in some of these cases, in some of the most well-known cases, the serial killer is very actively involved in creating their own public identity.
Well, that's the question with Jack the Ripper, since it's said that he may have written letters, or at least one.
Yeah.
So where would he fall if he's just a homicidal maniac, but yet he's trying to frighten the public, as it were? Where does that place him, do you think? Or do you not believe that he really tried to establish himself publicly?
I think those letters were frauds. I actually think that they were written by the media, by journalists, to just fuel the flames of the Jack the Ripper story. The reason that Jack the Ripper, it's probably the greatest whodunit of all time, and I'm actually very excited. I think I can announce that I've been asked by one of the networks to get involved in a Jack the Ripper project to bring it up to date and discuss the latest information and why it's an enduring story after all these years, after 130 years almost. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that the proliferation of broadsheet newspapers in London had just the technology had just emerged to the point that it was just waiting for a story like Jack the Ripper that needed to be updated every day. And in fact, the Jack the Ripper story was the first one in London that brought newspaper circulation to over a million copies a day in London. And of course, this was replicated around the world in major cities around the world, which is why Jack the Ripper became a worldwide phenomenon.
No news like bad news.
That's right. But to answer your question, I think that there's two letters that have been attributed to Jack the Ripper. One was signed from Hell, Jack the Ripper, and that's the one that, of course, was made into a movie with Johnny Depp. And the other one's called the Dear Boss Letter. I think that they were both forgeries designed to just fan the flames or fuel the flames of Jack the Ripper in the press.
Tom Westcott was our guest a number of times, and he has his own theories, and he certainly has been involved in the Ripperology community for quite a long time. But that's what I find fascinating about this, is depending on who you talk to, you can get a different angle on the case. And I tend to believe that certainly the newspapers benefited, and when you look at it from that angle, it makes sense that they would be forgeries. And then if you look at the crimes, they do seem very disorganized, almost like opportunities, quick opportunities. And then, I don't think many believe that we'll solve it one day, but I don't know that it's that simple.
No, I don't think so. Another thing about the Jack the Ripper case that's so fascinating is it was really the first attempt, and this is 1888, so there were no fingerprints, there was no blood evidence, there was clearly no DNA back in those days, there was nothing. In fact, the standard procedure with a crime scene was to wash it as quickly as possible to get rid of the blood so that it wouldn't shock Victorian society. So they basically... They didn't have the means of analyzing the evidence back then, but they destroyed it to begin with. But a police surgeon by the name of Thomas Bonds did probably what would have been considered the first real attempt to profile in the modern world. He was brought in after the five prostitute killings, and he was asked to look at all the forensic evidence, the bodies, photographs, everything that they had. And he absolutely refuted, which was one of the popular theories of the time, that it was a surgeon or a medical doctor because of the dismemberment and removing organs and stuff like that. And his conclusion was that this individual did not even have the skill of a common butcher. It was purely just, you know, ripping. I mean, it was literally dismemberment and ripping.
Yeah, I always got that that feeling that it's... It makes the story better if they were a butcher or if they were a doctor, but
yeah, exactly, and that is exactly what this this individual did. But there was a period there in the fall of 1888 in London that anyone with a medical bag walking down the street was a suspect, and so that was one of the predominant theories of the time. But as you mentioned, and it's the reason that it's such an enduring story until this day, and books and movies and everything else, is there's at least 100 theories, at least 100 different theories about who Jack the Ripper was.
So what are some of the other topics in your book that you wanted to talk about that we haven't asked you about yet?
Well, one of the most interesting things that I found, and you know, I have prior to becoming a criminologist, I was I worked in the media field, and I worked in advertising for a number of years, and it became very apparent to me in that my former profession that news is entertainment. You know, I mean, it's on the surface it's supposed to, you know, inform us, but it really is entertainment. And now with the proliferation of television channels and the internet and instant messaging and Twitter and everything else, there's so much competition that you have to sensationalize. You know, if it's not really is sensational and quick and grabs your attention, you're going to overlook it. And so there's this need really to sensationalize crime stories. And so I looked at and my thinking was that this is not done just by sensational tabloids, but by the mainstream media. So one of the things that I did is over a 20-year period, I looked at articles in the New York Times and articles in Time magazine on serial killers. I was able to pull, using Google Plus, you know, anything dealing with serial killers. And so there were hundreds of articles in Time magazine, a weekly, and there were thousands of articles in the New York Times over that period dealing with serial killers. Interestingly, in both news media, the New York Times paper and Time magazine, an identical 33% of the articles use some combination of the words evil, monster, vampire, Dracula. So even in these media that would be considered more highbrow intellectual media, you know, for an educated audience, Time magazine and the New York Times, even they sensationalize these stories. It's not surprising then. It's really not surprising that that individuals like Dahmer and Gacy and Bundy and Rader become celebrity monsters when it's just the way they're referred to. You know, they're spoken of in inhuman terms, and when you do that, it turns them into Dracula and turns them into, you know, almost immortals. And that's when the story gets so fascinating, because the police who chase them become very much like Van Helsing in the Dracula story, chasing the vampire. And there have been, in real life, a number of these stories that have played out, including with Dennis Rader. There was a police detective by the name of Ken Landwehr, who, sadly, he died about a year ago as well, but he's the one who actually caught Dennis Rader after 30 years. And the way that he caught him was this game of cat and mouse. And Dennis Rader had been writing to him and believed that they had developed a relationship. Dennis Rader was caught because of his own massive ego. He said, "Ken, I want to send you something on a floppy disk." This is back in the days, you know, when we used floppy disks. And he said, "Now, you can't trace any information that I'm going to send you on this floppy disk, right?" And Ken said, "No, of course not, Dennis. I can't, you know, I can't trace that." Well, guess what? Dennis Rader had deleted his name and the address of the church where he was the president of the church association on this floppy disk. That's how they got him. So he was really victimized by his own egomania.
Wow. I didn't realize that that's how he got caught.
That's right.
That's shocking because
yep.
His lack of knowledge of technology, me being a PC tech, that would just be, you know, checkmate.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Dennis is almost 70 years old, and of course he was caught back in 2005, so it's a little while ago. But it is surprising. But this gets to this strange sense of responsibility and ethics. Even if you had Dennis Rader here and you would ask him, are you an ethical man? He would say, absolutely. I am a man of my word. I am honest. I am a Christian, because he compartmentalizes everything. You know, he sees no contradiction between being a family man, husband, Christian, church leader, and a serial killer torturer. There's no contradiction there in his mind, because he compartmentalizes it all. And he was mortified, therefore, that Ken Landwehr, who he thought was his buddy, this police detective who was chasing him, he was mortified that Ken Landwehr would actually lie to him. And when he was apprehended, one of the first things that Dennis Rader said to Ken Landwehr is, Ken, I can't believe it. I cannot believe that you would lie to me. Why did you do that? And Ken Landwehr said, because I was trying to catch you. What do you think? And it speaks to Dennis Rader's psychopathy and this strange sort of ethics that it was just beyond his comprehension. But perhaps a final indication of his narcissism is when he was sitting in interrogation, and all the cops, probably half the force of Wichita, Kansas, was sitting there with him, interrogating him. And of course, he's basking in his glory now, because it's his opportunity to tell them what fools they were and how they were unable to catch him. And he looked around and he said, "Are we going to be here for a while?" And they said, yeah, I think we're going to be here for a while, Dennis. And he said, well, in that case, would you please mark my coffee mug BTK, because I don't want it mixed in with yours.
Oh, wow. Well, but don't we all compartmentalize? I mean, whether it be our religious beliefs, our political beliefs, just the way we would parent, the way we would wash our own car. I mean, don't we have our own ways of doing things and think that we know best and other people are wrong? I mean, I think we're all kind of hypocrites, or we're all kind of weird like that, but just not on the same level as, say, BTK.
Yeah, I see your point. I do understand your point. And I think we all, you know, probably do compartmentalize to a certain extent, just not to the extreme that, you know, that he does. I mean, he actually, this is a rationalization. Criminologists, we call it a neutralization technique. It's a way he neutralizes his guilt. He says, how can you, meaning society, how can you condemn me? He said, I am no different than a shark or a venomous snake. I was born to kill. I am a natural born killer. So how can you condemn me? He believes it, you know, but of course he believes it, because that neutralizes any guilt that he might otherwise feel.
Well, it goes back to, is there truly good and evil, or is it just our perception and interpretation of what we perceive as good and evil?
Yep. Well, see, he would say that he's not evil. He would say that he was born to kill, and he's not evil at all. He's just doing his natural instincts. So he would say that's probably a gift. He would call it a gift from God, the fact that he's a natural predator.
Yeah. I mean, do we get on the shark for killing the seal? Do we get on the lion for taking down the gazelle? No, because that's just nature, and that's how he perceives himself.
Right. Yeah. But what he doesn't see is that sharks and hawks don't fantasize and obsess, I don't think, about torturing and killing. You know, they just do what they do. It's their instinct. Whereas he fantasized and got off sexually by doing these terrible things.
Or these things are doing it for hunger and survival. He's going to survive just fine if he's not killing anybody.
Exactly.
Scott, if you can go ahead and, by the way, do you know if your book is available on Audible?
Oh, it is. Yes. My once again, the title of my book is Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers. And it is available in print. It's available in ebook, both Kindle and Nook. And it's also available from Audible. It's available as an audiobook. And, of course, you can buy it on the Amazon website, the Barnes & Noble website. It's available in bookstores nationwide. And I hope that people enjoy it. It's a different look. You know, it's a different look at this topic. It's more, you know, in many ways, it's about us. It's about our fascination with serial killers and how they have become these celebrity monsters. So I hope, you know, I hope your listeners may enjoy it.
I'm out on Wicked Deeds right now.
The first article that I wrote for Wicked Deeds is the difference between a sociopath and psychopath, and that one article has been read almost a million times around the world. It's amazing.
Well, thank you so much for coming on to talk with us.
This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
WHY.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.